Tonight's masterclass. It's December 1st, 2022, and we have four presenters tonight. We have Robin Clark, Lauren Galvin, White Knapp, and Michael Huskin. Robin, if you are ready, you can lead us off.
Awesome. Ready, let me get this going.
I can see your screen.
Awesome. Well, welcome to my masterclass, Keys to Implementing a Vulnerability Management Program, or as I like to call it, the seedy underbelly of vulnerability management. A vulnerability management program is a framework for managing risk and the detection of vulnerabilities throughout the environment. The aim is to secure the organization's assets against malicious actors, accidental and intentional, to alter, destroy, steal proprietary and sensitive data of the organization, its clients, and partners by proactively protecting against the exploitation of existing security flaws and vulnerabilities. This concerted effort includes the regular, expeditious patching of software vulnerabilities, hardening, and securely configuring devices for starters. Many organizations are at a loss when it comes to how best to build and implement a vulnerability management program that can comprehensively secure their environment. Many think they have nothing a cyber criminal wants. However, how will a cyber criminal know that to be the case without breaking in and taking a look around? That very thinking and the reality are what makes a vulnerability management program a necessity for a business, regardless of size and industry. This talk aims to be a roadmap focusing on key components of establishing and maturing a vulnerability management program. The common reasons for failed implementations usually start with the three P's: policy, process, and people. As with most things, the top sets the tone. And if there's a lackluster support or buy-in from the executives, then this endeavor will fail. If there are no approved policies and procedures, that leaves room for errors, gaps in security, inability to scale or repeat processes, and is not conducive to automation. Or there is a lack of baselines or metrics, and goals are not defined or are incomplete. The lack of technical know-how at any level will lead to gaps in the scanning of the environment. The vulnerability management program cannot be treated as a one-and-done effort. It needs to be continuous, sustained effort with an eye towards always improving. Failure to clearly define roles and responsibilities leads to zero accountability. So in the time of need, no one knows where to go to, and that leads to frustrations and finger pointing, which then leads to an absence of transparency and communication between IT and cybersecurity teams, as well as the teams responsible for remediation of vulnerabilities. All involved must speak the same language and be comfortable in knowing the difference between vulnerabilities, exploits, and threats. Vulnerability is a weakness that exists in software, hardware, configurations, and physical security. And sadly, people are the weak link still. Exploits are the methods used by cyber criminals to leverage and twist the vulnerability to their benefit. And the threat is the hypothetical damage that will result from a successful cyber attack exploiting the vulnerability. Now, how will you identify risk and which controls will be implemented to mitigate them? In order to identify risks, you need to know your baselines and which threats are actually applicable to your environment. Once those are identified, then the team can plot out which type of controls will be needed. The vulnerability management program must be run as a project, and it starts with resolve. The baselines are established and a course of action is charted. It will need to end with a commitment to actually implementing. To that end, a project manager will be required to facilitate engagement, set agendas, engage and allocate resources, and ensure the progress is moving along on time and within budget. And speaking of engagement, key decision makers must be involved. There is no way around it. From top senior leadership to the C-suite, the term budget is key as it truly indicates the level of resolve and commitment. In some instances, there are two budgets, one for the project while the framework, meaning policies, tools, resources, either training the existing or adding new staff, is being set, and the annual one for the actual implementation of the vulnerability management program year after year. Leadership must not only support and define the policies, but a consensus must be reached regarding roles and responsibilities. Everyone must understand the who, what, when, where, why, and how associated with every single role. So in the time of need, everyone is reading from the same playbook and has the same understanding. Hardware and software asset management are critical to the foundation and success of the vulnerability management program. It improves the overall IT organization by allowing for better insight and planning, greatly improves the risk analysis because you know what you have, allows for thorough mapping of software to hardware, that is, what applications are installed on which devices, where are they installed, and whether they are vital or need to be removed. Lastly, it allows for the system owner of every application to be identified, and thus who is ultimately accountable for it. By actually knowing what exists in your environment, you can then prioritize and assess which assets are critical to the operation of your organization. With this information, remediation teams now have actionable data by which they can set a valid and consistent scan schedule, and therefore not waste time and resources by remediating everything. As the saying goes, we need to work smarter, not harder. And by using the proper tools for asset inventory coupled with policies and inventory management, these will help set the asset criticality. Also, the number of available threat intelligence feeds seems endless. Therefore, it's imperative that the research is done to ensure the cybersecurity team is following those that are applicable to the organization and its industry. This will help filter out a lot of noise and help keep the team focused on only relevant feeds and threats. Tracking every threat that exists is not feasible, nor does it do your organization any good. While your security team is out chasing red herrings, your assets are being plundered. So focus only on what is real and relevant to the organization. Organizations must decide upon the best way to quantitatively calculate the risk to them, and that will lead to a uniform way in which to rank, rate, and ultimately remediate vulnerabilities. The formulas range from super simple to complex, and a good starting point for any organization with a very immature security portfolio is to start simple. And as the organization matures security-wise, then a more sophisticated formula may be adopted. But be sure everything still aligns with the reality of what you are protecting and how you are protecting it. If you have a situation where the risk of exploit X being successful will cost you $10,000, but the cost to remediate it is $100,000, then the risk response and applicable corrective actions, whether technical, administrative, or physical, must be put in place to mitigate it. Organizations need to follow the vulnerability management lifecycle so they don't end up feeling as if they are on a quest to Mordor without any capable companions. The conversation returns to baselines. They're needed to create and set performance key indicators and metrics and hold the responsible parties accountable. When setting the metrics, this is a good time to have discussions with your vendors and IT team, because it truly allows for learning what the software or hardware can or cannot do, proper placement for it to do its job, and also how to roll out the scanning in phases as to not overload the network and its resources. When conducting a comprehensive review of government and industry regulations to identify and address compliance shortcomings, organizations must take into account the markets they operate and sell their products in. This piece is important because designing a vulnerability management program with compliance requirements in mind will not only ensure the organization is fulfilling its obligations, but will go a long way in protecting its goodwill, bottom line, keeping the company from being fined, and executives from being jailed. Automation is the heart of the vulnerability management program because it is scalable, reduces human error, is repeatable, and will be relevant as long as everyone does their due diligence and has the proper sources and inputs set, which goes back to tracking relevant threats. With the cyber threat landscape constantly evolving, there's no shortage of alerts regarding new and resurgent attacks on all vectors, or new trends, or new malicious actors joining the scene along with new tools. With organizations redefining their needs and those of their clients, cybersecurity teams must constantly review every facet of their vulnerability management program and tweak the metrics and tools. This continuous improvement also extends to the three P's: policy, process, and people. Having a vulnerability management program leads to increased morale and retention among the IT and cybersecurity teams. The passion for work increases when they have the proper support, resources, tools, and time to grow and learn, which allows them to increase their visibility with management, leverage new skills into more responsibilities, thus moving within and growing with the organization as they endeavor to support it and mature the security posture. This process is by no means all-encompassing. Excuse me. It is a good starting point. The details and layers will be determined by the organization's needs, compliance requirements, budget, and skill level of the various teams. My hope for every organization is this process makes the road to security accessible, less daunting, and a lot clearer, because not one business can afford to not have a relevant vulnerability management program. Still, it will all be for naught if every person in the organization is not engaged, entrusted, and vigilant. The only other option is hemorrhaging losses due to breaches, regardless of whether they make the headlines or not. But with planning, resolve, and commitment, your organization will be an ongoing concern for years and years to come. Thank you.
All right, that was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Learned a lot. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
Especially what you said about the soft dev, that really, the development, that really speaks to me, vulnerabilities and stuff.
Right. And I'm a process person, and it's interesting watching all of the politics and all the different things surrounding something you would think are just basic. But there's just a lot of inroads still to be made at billion-dollar companies. It's unimaginable. But also, I wanted to do this because sometimes for people going into a new situation, whether this is their first cyber role or a new company, you go in and you're like, I'm going to screw up logging in with my credentials. Like, you really are terrified. So it's always good to kind of have that one thing that you really feel good about. Or say, hey, I kind of know this, or this sounds familiar. So I kind of wanted to do that for them as well.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I forgot to add before we started everything, if you guys have any questions for any of the presenters, please write them down and ask them after everybody's done presenting. That way, you know, we can move right along. So with that said, Lauren, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready to go. She just killed it with that zone bit.
I know.
Some shoes to fill. So, all right.
You'll do great.
All right.
I have faith in you.
Appreciate it. All right. You should hopefully be working. You guys see the screen and all that?
Yep.
All right. Cool.
Take it away.
All right. Appreciate it. All right. So I got it like as a presentation that's going to run. So if there's any audio issues, just let me know. I have it also saved on YouTube, but if that ends up not working, because we know how technology can be, I can just, I have the slides saved, so I can just present it that way. But let me play the audio. This guy should let me know if you can hear it and all that. See if that just worked real quick before I keep playing.
I can't hear anything. Did you share with audio?
Let me try it again. But I did. Oh, I did not. All right, should be good now.
Let's see.
Hey there, y'all.
How's it yep, going? I can
hear
it.
All right, cool. All right, cool. Okay.
Yeah,
all right. Let's start it. I'm going to mute my mic just to make sure it keeps working. So, yeah. All right, yeah, I'll turn it up. I got you. Just didn't want to blast everyone's eardrums. All right, you guys, just let me know if the audio needs to be adjusted or anything. I'm going to mute my mic so there's no background noise. So, yeah.
Hey there, y'all. How's it going? My name's Lauren, and this is going to be my presentation for Masterclass today on cyber attacks. So some background before I go more in depth about like what I'm going to talk about throughout this whole presentation and all that. So a specific question I've been asked a lot is, you know.
It's weird. It's low. Hang on. I might know what it is. Hold up. You chef sharing for 1 minute. Hang on. I got y'all. I think I know what it is. Try my Teams as a whole. I have to turn down the audio because it's super loud. All right, do it again real quick.
Just share with sound.
Yeah, I got you. Sorry about that. All right. I guess just let me know if that's better.
More in depth about like what I'm going to talk about throughout this whole presentation and all that.
All right, cool.
So a specific question I've been asked a lot is, you know, why did I want to pursue a degree in cybersecurity? So back, you know, I've always had a love. Let me start with this. First, I've always had a love for, you know, IT and technology and all that. Like, it's just something I wanted to do. Like, I went to online high school starting my 10th grade year because I just wasn't liking the education I was getting in brick and mortar public school. In person, so I moved to a public online school my 10th grade year, and I graduated with that same school. It was a Texas Online Preparatory School. I was the top of my class. I was president of student council. I started the student council there, and I just fell in love with it. So toward the end of, you know, my high school career, I was being asked, you know, what did I want to do after high school? What did I want to pursue in college? All at that point, like at that point, it was about beginning of my senior year. All I knew is I wanted to do something IT. So I was thinking, you know, just go maybe get like a basic IT degree and just go from there. So it's just, I didn't know totally what I wanted to do. But I had talked to some people because I do a lot of gaming online. I've talked to people and I've met people who I'm really good friends with now that actually have careers within the cybersecurity field. And as well have gone to college for cybersecurity. So they got to tell me a little bit of rundown of like what I'll experience. And I'm like, wow, this actually sounds like something I really want to do. Something I can, you know, help people. Is this something I want to do? I've always wanted to be trying to help people. And I feel like this is something I can do. You know, telling some people that like some of the courses I've taken throughout college, like one of them being ethical hacking, they're like, ethical hacking, how's hacking ethical? I'm like, well, it's not like us truly like hacking. We're stopping hackers by, you know, doing counters for, you know, for their attacks and stuff, kind of pretty much cyber attacks, and doing stuff like that. So that's why I knew I wanted to pursue in cybersecurity, because I felt like I could do so much good and, you know, better for people. So, and that's why I grew more of an interest for it. I look at statistics and I look at data recording, you know, regarding that and all that such. So, you know, when I was coming up with this masterclass presentation, I just could not get an idea, you know, for the life of me. I really was trying to think what I wanted to talk about. So, you know, there's two things that I'm going to talk about here that kind of made me lead toward why I want to talk about cyber attacks with y'all tonight and talk about them more in depth. One, I do a lot of like watching on my YouTube and Twitch, and I was just doing some late night YouTube, you know, just trying to chill out for the night before I went and lay down. And a video actually came across my feed. I'm just talking about this guy who's Jim, and he stops scammers. So he's kind of like how I look at it, how cybersecurity people are. He's doing the same thing that scammers are doing, but doing it for the better. So he scams scammers, or he can tap into their things and see what they're doing. So he knows, you know, he exposes them and he helps people. In the video, I can link it if someone really wants it. It's by Vice, and they went and talked to him, and he tries to help as many people as he can. He's also trying to bring awareness to what these scammers are doing, because personally, my family, not myself, my family has been affected by this. When I was, a few months ago, I was in the hospital getting some testing done for some stuff. My mom ended up getting a call, and it was posing as our energy company, but it ended up being a scammer. And that just, she started giving information, and then she thought about it, but she just totally wasn't thinking. You know, we all have those moments when we're not thinking. And, you know, that happened, and she's like, oh my gosh, I'm getting scammed. So she hung up immediately. She contacted the energy company, and they told her this has actually been happening lately. And it is true. Scammers are getting better at what they do, and more scams are happening per year. And all, you know, scams and cyber attacks for sure go hand in hand. Like, I'll go into an later slide, but cyber attacks have grown even more, and scams even more throughout the last couple of years and even decades, because technology as a whole has, you know, evolved as well. You know, technology evolving is for the better, more in my opinion, but also obviously has its flaws, just as everything does. So cyber attacks, I know some of my friends who have been affected by them as well. Just some people don't really take the precautions they really need to when they're using, you know, their technology devices, like their computer or even their phone, because cyber attacks have evolved and changed so much that those people can tap into literally anything. It's actually unreal. But yeah, we'll go into this next slide. So let's just jump right into it. What are cyber attacks? Let's go into NIST, you know, they have an article on there. They have a lot of good information on there. A cyber attack is a type of malicious activity in which occurs that is attempting to collect, disrupt, deny, degrade, or destroy information, systems, resources, or information itself. So pretty much cyber attacks are bad. They're, you know, just simple as that. Just try to think about it. Cyber attacks equal bad. It's an attacker doing these attacks for a specific reason. Most of the time, cyber attacks are to, you know, get people to pay up something, you know, maybe usually money, maybe information or whatever. Some of these attackers just do it, you know, for the thrill of it. They just want to do it, or they're just trying to expose someone or something or an organization for something that's like, you know, deeper into their systems and their network that like isn't obviously being shown to public light. So by the end of the day, cyber attacks equal bad. It's just how I look at it. So when was and what was the first major cyber attack to take place? So the first cyber attack that occurred was in 1988, and its host was from it was from a computer at MIT, actually. And this cyber attack actually affected a lot of different computer systems at various schools that include like Stanford and UC Berkeley, but also even attacked NASA. We know how big NASA is nowadays. It actually hit networks and systems with these, you know, those two different schools and even other types of schools and even NASA, that the cyber attack occurred, and it got information and, you know, like sensitive information and data, obviously, you know, that each of these places has within their system and networks. And this attack pretty much got hold of this data as a whole. You know, there's already attacks occurring that were known as cybercrime, but this one that happened in 1988 was truly the first major cyber attack to take place, because like cybercrime dated back all the way back to 1962 when Allen he launched an attack actually at MIT again on their computer networks. And he was stealing passwords from databases associated with MIT, the school itself, by using a punch card. Obviously, this is back before the internet and everything was a thing. So he was doing it with the most like basic technology they had at that time before the internet really became a thing. And he was obviously just attacking the database, like a network and the systems associated with the school. Nothing that was associated anywhere else like the 1988 attack did. So, how have cyber attacks changed and evolved over the years? One major way, in my opinion, that cyber attacks have changed and evolved over the years is how much more complex they have become nowadays. And I'm going to go into the next slide about different cyber attacks that occur. But, you know, like I said, with technology evolving and changing for the better, most in my opinion, you know, obviously it has its flaws, those being these cyber attacks. As technology has evolved and everything, cyber attacks have as well. Some cyber attacks that happen nowadays are just, they're crazy. It's just, it's kind of astonishing to see how much time and effort some of these attackers do, because some of these attacks, obviously they're not like, the process of them aren't just taking place over like a day. These attackers really are taking the time to like think about what they're going to do and how their attack's going to take place and all that. And then they just do it, you know? So, you know, there's many different types of informs, cyber attacks that, you know, people have to look out for nowadays. Like, you know, the list kind of goes on forever and it's just, it's kind of sad, but people should be aware and they should, you know, they should be aware on, you know, what they're doing. Like, you know, being in person, you should always be aware of your surroundings. You should also be aware of your surroundings online. That's just how it is. The internet is a really big place and it's full of information and data, but it's also full of, you know, those scammers and those cyber attackers and, you know, malicious people, malicious activities. It's just how it is. You know, it's recorded that 2,200 cyber attacks happen each day. And, you know, if you do the math, you add it all up, that's 800,000 people that get affected per year. And that doesn't sound maybe like that biggest number to some people, but it's actually, that's very alarming because, you know, these cyber attacks, whatever they're getting their hands on really can, you know, affect even more people than that 800,000 at the end of the day. So some of the cyber attacks in which they occur are, you know, malware, very common type of cyber attack. I would say most people who like have a computer or somewhat some good knowledge of technology and all that know what that is. You know, malware attacks, they take that deeper dive into one system's networks. You know, they're going to crack the passwords that are associated with one's account or accounts. That, you know, the passwords are more simple, like, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's why, you know, when you make an account, like on a website nowadays, they'll be like, you know, Google, I know my Google does it. It pops up, be like, yeah, let's create you a stronger password. Personally, I don't ever do that because I don't trust it. I try to go always with my own password. But if people do a simple password, an easier password, obviously it's going to be easier for them to remember, but it's also how I look at it. It's going to be easier for a cyber attacker to crack and, you know, do all that. You know, Trojan horse concept is being used, you know, it looks legit and then it ends up not being legit at all. You know, people get attacked, scammed, you know, all that. Or, you know, ransomware is being used by the attacker at hand. You know, it's just how people do it. And then that next type of attack, it's kind of like a baiting type of cyber attack, you know, kind of phishing for it is how I look at it. It tricks people by, you know, sending a fake message like an email. Like, it's crazy. I've seen this firsthand. Someone I know got an email and it was post. They had a Netflix account. So, you know, sometimes when emails come through, like I get text messages on my phone all the time and then emails that are like saying, oh, this needs to be renewed or this and that. Like sometimes I get like an Amazon email and I'm like, but I don't have Amazon. I use my mom's Amazon account. So obviously, I'm not in charge of Amazon, so I'm not going to need to reset anything for it. So I just, you know, obviously ignore those emails. But I saw one firsthand, like I said, with Netflix. My buddy, he had Netflix, and he got an email. And he's like, hey, Lauren, can you look at this? I'm like, yeah, sure. And it was saying that his payment was wrong. And I was like, well, when was the last time he paid? And he told me he paid, like, about a week ago. I'm like, well, you shouldn't be getting another email yet about needing to pay because it's a monthly subscription. So I like looked at the email in depth. It looked 100% legit. The only thing that threw me off is that there was a singular typo at the very bottom, like in fine print. And I was like, do not respond to that. It's a baiting type of attack. It's looking legit. And someone's trying to get an entry point from you clicking the link in that email. And they're going to scam you. And Yeah, he ended up not doing it, and I think I kind of saved his accounts, because, I mean, by that happening, the cyber attack, it's just giving the entry point for attackers and everything to get into your system, your network, and your devices, and they can do whatever they want. I mean, that's just how it is in today, sadly. And then there's denial of service attacks, you know, DOS, and it's like a shutdown type of attack. If this attack truly gets on one's devices, it's kind of like, it's over. You can't really do anything at that point in time, at least. You're going to be totally shut out from all your systems, your network, or even, like, the machine you're working, like your computer. You're not going to be able to operate at all. It's cutting you off from accessing anything, and that's how the attacker really can get their hands on any information and such you may have. You know, so I'm going to end this is, you know, this is a lot, one of the last slides I got here. You know, how can one prevent themselves from being a victim of cyber attacks? And this is, you know, I try to preach to people, you know, just being 21 and, like, someone who's younger. I feel like the younger generations obviously have a better grasp on technology than maybe, like, the older generations, kind of like my parents, because my parents are, like, in their late 50s, early 60s. So, you know, something I try to tell them and I try to preach to, like, my parents' friends or, like, you know, the older generations, you know, some of these ways I've listed below. Because, you know, some people don't know the signs to look for that they're being attacked or scammed or whatever it may be, becoming a victim. Because once you become a victim, it's really sometimes hard to get out of it. There is ways to get out of it. But, you know, if you can stop yourself from, you know, you can prevent yourself, obviously, from becoming a victim from the start, you'll be much better off. So creating those stronger passwords. You know, not doing the simple passwords and all that. Really think about, like, a password that you're going to kind of remember and all that. I mean, if you feel like you're not going to remember a password, at the end of the day, just take out a sticky note, you know, write it down, put it on your desk or, like, put it in a drawer, obviously. And that's a way you can remember it. I usually try not to always save my passwords within browsers because I just don't know what's going to happen. Or I change my passwords every couple months. I know that probably sounds a bit weird, but it's just something I kind of do because I want to make sure it's always kind of changing so that I'm good. Make sure your software is always up to date. If you're kind of behind with software, it kind of gives attackers an easier point to make entry and do their stuff. You know, also looking into the antivirus software is never a bad idea. I personally have it, and I've been much better off. And it gives me, like, alerts when I feel like it's making me go, if I'm going to a website that they think is suspicious and everything, gives me an alert, so I'm more cautious, and I look into it. You know, always look out for that suspicious activity, which can occur in your accounts, such as bank accounts. You know, make sure if you see something weird, you know, contact your bank or contact, you know, the charge associated with it and be like, yo, why did I get hit with this, if you really want to. And then finally, always just be aware when you're browsing the internet, especially new websites you might be visiting. You know, websites, you know, attackers are really good at, you know, their attacks, hiding them more in depth now lately, is from what I noticed. Like, just from that email that my buddy got, like, it did look legit. The only thing that threw me off was the typo at the bottom. And I wish I had a screenshot to show y'all, but it was actually kind of crazy. I was like, wow, this is actually kind of unreal. So, you know, that's everything I got.
We go and cut off there because I know what Angela said about questions at the end, but that's all I got. Appreciate it, y'all. All right. And yeah.
Thanks. You did a great job, and I understood every word. It wasn't too fast, so that was great. Wyatt, are you ready?
I am. Let me get my all screen right. Shared here. Okay. Well, in keeping with the theme of cybersecurity, or security in general this evening, I am discussing conditional access policies, specifically within the Microsoft 365 environment. So, with that said, we'll go over what is conditional access, some recommended conditional access policies. We'll do some demos with that to show you how to set them up. We'll go over multi-factor authentication policies that can tie into conditional access things. Have some demos there, and then a little bonus tip at the end. So what is conditional access? Essentially, it's a set of rules that can limit the access of users or devices based on a set of predefined conditions. Those conditions can include things like location, device settings, or the security state that the device has. it is important to note that you don't necessarily want to apply it to every account. High-risk accounts, certainly, but there are some service accounts and things that you would not want to apply conditional access to because it can break access for services and things like that. So, some recommended conditional access policies. Like I said before, it's location-based or can be location-based. You can allow it from specific locations, either IP address-based or coordinate-based. Or you can deny from specific countries or things like that. You can require MFA as a conditional condition of access. Specifically, I like that one for risky sign-ins. So risky sign-in is something that Microsoft deems as highly unlikely, i.e. A geographical difference. So you sign in Los Angeles, and then 10 minutes later, you signed in Maine. And they're like, hey, that's probably not legit. So let's flag that and require multi-factor authentication. Even if the device looks legit, we're still going to require it because it was risky. You might apply a conditional access policy to prevent persistent logins. This would be useful if you've got people that are signing in on maybe not their own device. Hey, somebody went to the library and logged in. You would not want that session to stay open. So you could say, hey, if it's an unmanaged device, we're going to kick you off after a certain period of time, or you're going to have to re-authenticate. And then, like I said, it can also be applied toward the device and settings there. So you could set a minimum operating system version or whether the device has antivirus enabled. Those are just a few of the things. There's many, many, many other things that you can base these on. So now it's demo time with that. And so I'm going to pull up. I've set up a Microsoft 365 environment in Azure to show some of these demos on. And so first I'm going to sign into their endpoint portal. This is basically Intune. It's used to manage devices. And so I'm going to show you this first because for a lot of these policies, you'll have to have a device compliance policy set up. And so to do that, you sign into their endpoint manager and you come into endpoint security. And let's see, additional access. I thought I had it set up. Services. Oh, in here, device compliance, that's what I'm looking for. So I went ahead and set up a device compliance policy. And if we come look at the properties of it, it's a very basic one. And I said, hey, the device has to have BitLocker enabled and turned on, has to have the code integrity feature enabled, has to have a minimum device version of this, and then a bunch of security things. You got to have your firewall turned on. It's got to have a TPM chip, antivirus, anti-spyware, all that jazz. In order to be compliant, your device has to meet all of those things. So once that's set up, we can go into the Azure portal. Got too many sessions open, I think. So we come into the Active Directory portal. There's a couple things that we're going to set up for demos in here as well. If we go to security, named location. So we need to set these up in order to blacklist or whitelist where we can allow people to log in from. So we will do a new country's location. And we're going to say whitelist. And we're going to say just the United States is on our whitelist. So now we have a whitelist, and we could add other countries to that. It doesn't have to be just one. But we're also going to create a blacklist. And we are going to, for purposes of this, we don't want anything coming out of Russia. Blacklist, whitelist, and then we can also specify a specific IP address. And so this might be, hey, corporate offices. So I'm going to name it HQ. It's a trusted location, and then I just got to put in the IP address. So I'm just going to give it a really basic one. So only IP addresses from, or only devices with this IP address will be allowed to do whatever this we set this for. So I have a blacklist, a whitelist, and a headquarters. So now we can go in and actually build our conditional access policy. So the first policy that we're going to do is an allow from a selected location. So I'll go ahead and create, name my policy. Policy name, we're going to choose the users that this is applied to, and we're going to apply it to everybody. Now, they do give you a warning, say, hey, don't lock yourself out, because if you apply it to all users, it will apply to you too. And if you don't qualify for it, you're going to lock yourself out of your environment. So be careful. And then for cloud apps, this is going to apply to anything in the Microsoft 365 environment. That is Exchange Online, your email, Teams, anything like that. The condition, so we will select that. And the condition is based on your location. And we will say a selected location. And we're going to say our whitelist. And then down here, we will grant access. Select. And you're going to require multi-factor authentication. So by default, they're going to give you the option to exclude yourself. I'm going to leave it because this is going to be a report only. So if you leave it as report only, you will be able to run. It will get logged, basically, in the Azure logs, but it won't actually apply. I'm actually going to go ahead and turn it on since I'm in the U.S. Now, the only way that we can log in to our environment is if we are in the United States, and that's what our IP address will indicate based on other data, not based specifically on the IP address. We can also do a block policy, say, hey, we want to allow people to log in from anywhere except if they're in Russia. We don't want to do that. So we'll call this a new policy. We'll say block from blocked. Apply it to everybody. Apply it to all apps under the condition that if your location is on our blacklist, then we will block your access. So you probably wouldn't run both of these policies at the same time. You would either run a whitelist, which is what this is, or a blacklist, which is what this is. You're probably better off running a whitelist because that way if something new comes up, not that there's new countries, but if something new pops up, it's going to be blocked by default. That's generally the best method when it comes to security. We can also create a policy to require multi-factor authentication. So if we do that, we'll do a new one, require A. This will also apply to everybody. It will apply to all logins. And then the condition that we will grant access is require multi-factor authentication. So you can see in here that the state of some of these are report only. You can go in and turn them on when you're ready to. You might run it in report only for a while just to see what might be affected. And that way you're not interrupting actual business operations. One other policy that I generally in favor of, it can be hard to do depending on the size of your organization, is to block multi-factor authentication device registration unless it's from a trusted location. So you might say, we'll only allow people to register a new device, an authenticator app on their phone, if they're at the corporate headquarters. If they're outside of that, you cannot register a new device. And this prevents attackers, if somebody even gets somebody's password and they can get in into their account online and try to register an authentication device so that they can have MFA access to their account, this would prevent that because they cannot register a device unless it's at the company headquarters coming from that IP address that we set up earlier. So I will set that up. So this is also going to apply to everybody for all apps. but it's going to actually be for user actions instead of applications. So register or join devices. And then the condition is going to include a location, and it's going to be our headquarters IP address. So then we go to our under the conditions, we also have to exclude all other locations. So anything from our blacklist is what we'll select now, but you would create your blacklist would have everything on it. Conditions that require registration. Oh, it's in the actions. Anyway, we would block access from that. I did something wrong here in the demo. Conditions that require. And eight, you must confirm. Ah. I have done something wrong in this policy. I'm gonna have to figure this out, but now is not the time. If it had worked, it would have prevented MFA device registration from another location other than the company headquarters. But you don't have to build your policies all yourself. There are templates in Office 365 or Microsoft 365. And the one that I use is for requiring multi-factor authentication for a risky login, which apparently it thinks I'm doing right now. So, like I talked about, if the services register that hey, that's not a likely login, we can require multi-factor authentication, and it's a pre-built policy here. You just come in and select it, and there you have it. Create policy, and you're off and running with that. So. I think that will do it for our MFA registration stuff, or our conditional access policies. I think I'm running out of time here. So the thing to know with MFA is not all methods are equal. We recommend the authenticator app or something like a FIDO2 key or something like that. SMS and voice calls are not secure. All of that stuff can be intercepted. So I'll run through a quick demo on how to set the type of MFA that your organization can require so that users can't select the unsecure methods. Back into here, the security and authentication methods. Authenticator, target all users, and then we can go to configure. And so we can force them to use passwordless authentication. Basically, it pops a number on the screen. You get a notification on your phone, and you have to enter that number that's in front of you. You can also set it to tell you what application is being signed in to when you do that, and you can also have it send you a little map that shows you the geographic location of that. So that's what I turned on there, and when a new user signs into this environment, they would be forced to use those methods, and they could not choose SMS or anything else from the list here. That's all disabled anyway. And then let's see. Our bonus tip is that you can do company branding on the login page. It defends against phishing. So if you notice, when I logged in here, it had a brown background and a Purdue Global icon. Let me see if I can get it to work here from an in private session. So you can do this from the Azure admin portal. This customizes your login page, and then you know what you're logging into. So much of the phishing attacks use generic Office 365 login pages, Microsoft branded, super easy to make, but it's going to be a little harder for them to customize what you log into. So if you set up something like this, you can help your users recognize if what they're logging into is legit. And that can be done in the company branding settings in here. I'm not going to go through it in the interest of time. Anyway, you can come in here and set up your page background color. You can set up a company logo, things like that. So I apologize for running over time quite a bit. That is my TED talk for the evening.
No worries. That was very interesting. Thank you. Michael, are you ready?
I am. Let me see if I can figure out how to share.
Okay. It's at the top bar next to the leave button, there's a share with a box and an up arrow.
Yep. I've got that. So then I just got to figure out how to share.
Okay, and then just
one.
Okay. All right. Where it says share content, next to that is include computer sound. Just toggle that button. There you go.
Just select the screen. Can you all see my screen?
Yep.
All right, I'll set this to presentation mode so it's a little bit easier. There, that should be nice and easy for everybody to see. All right, my talk tonight is about security technical implementation guides. And I'm currently getting a lot of involvement in this at my current job. But my memory of this goes all the way back to 2016 when I was deployed to Kuwait with the Army. And the Army offered a boot camp for, they had a local university there that offered boot camps for studying for Security Plus examination. And in the middle of that class, I had an aha moment that I realized that I probably didn't get the best instructor, and here's why. The instructor was rolling through. He had this big book of slides, and he's flipping them on his book as he's going through the slides, and he says, security tech, STIGs, you should know what STIGs are. And I asked him, I said, well, what are STIGs? And he said, a STIG is a security technical implementation guide. You really should know those for the exam. And he went on to the next topic. And I was like, well, wait a minute, you're teaching a whole bunch of DOD people, because it was all either active duty military or military contractors or military civilians that were taking this boot camp. And he glossed right over it. So ever since that point, the idea of STIGs have stuck in my head. And currently right now, I'm going through these with my job. And it's important that we should know these. And what we're doing that exposed me to this at work is we're going through what's called a command cyber readiness inspection. And it's actually taking us about a year to prepare. And I'll cover some of that. But we're getting so in depth that we have weekly update or status update calls on everything that's going on. There's a great deal of information that goes on. But I'm just going to give a cursory thing, discussion over this. It's actually led to some finger pointing because you get different departments covering different checklists. There's several dozen different checklists that break down into different categories. I'm working on what's called this traditional security checklist. So between myself and one of my subordinate organizations, like, no, that's your department. Well, wait a minute, your security. Yeah, but your security, and this falls under your network. So we have to work through a lot of things. And we're also having what's called staff assistance visits. So we just had somebody from the Army, refers to it as G6, basically our IT department. So we had somebody from, I work for the Corps of Engineers, and we had somebody from the what's called the GIO G6 IT department come and actually visit with us for 3 days to cover just the traditional security checklist, which is 148 items. So it took them almost 3 days to go through 148 items. And this week, any of you that have been involved in the DoD space, I'm sure you've heard of SIPR, which is the Secure Internet Protocol Router System. The rest of our IT department is actually going through a SIPR security assistance visit this week. And we've got several of these going between now and next, I think it's April or May that we have our inspection. So a lot going on. I'll move on to the next slide. And what are STIGs? They're requirements that are derivative of the NIST 800-53. There's three major categories, CAT 1, CAT 2, or 3. A CAT 1 finding will result in the loss of authority to operate. So in our example, we're very concerned about that because we have both the standard protocol NIPR and we have our SIPR protocol. If we lose our authority to operate, we won't be able to do any of our classified work that we do. And it's important that we keep that going. You lose your authority to operate, you can't do anything at all till you fix that. And it's not an easy process to get a new authority to operate. A CAT 2 finding has the potential for unauthorized access. And a CAT 3 is recommendations that improve your information assurance awareness process. Forgive me, getting a little bit of a dry throat here. Been a long day. in CAT 1 weaknesses, they should receive the highest priority for correction and mitigation. Typically, a CAT 1 weakness must be corrected before you can get your authority to operate will be granted. But in our case, we already have that authority, but we don't want to lose it. And during our recent SAV, we actually only had one CAT 1 finding, and it's relatively minor and fixable. This collection presents the analysis with compliance information from STIG audits that have been conducted within the environment. Data is presented on the number of STIGs and presents a pass or fail. And I'm going to show you some of the tools that we can have to track this these items as you go through, because like I said, they're pretty lengthy. So again, STIGs can be broken down into approximately 20 different domains. Some of the major categories are network infrastructure, operating systems. As I mentioned before, I do traditional security. So I'm doing like anti-terrorism, physical security, and controls of that nature. So that's my wheelhouse there. But if you were to count them up, there are thousands of individual STIGs. What I'm showing you here on the right side of this slide is what's called STIG Viewer. That's a publicly available website that the average public can go look at if you want to use STIGs even for a civilian organization. And I'll give that on a resources page at the end if anybody wants the address for that. But you can actually go through and find out what the STIGs are. And when you click on each one of those links that you see there, you could look at the description and what's called the check fix. The check fix will tell you the steps you need to do to ensure that you're in compliance with that particular STIG. This slide here is what's called the traditional STIG viewer. This is what the government, the Department of Defense, has used for years. You'll see over here on the left-hand part of the slide is a pie chart. And this is representative of, this is just generic, but all the green in the pie chart means that the STIGs for this particular checklist, and you can see, I don't know if you can see it on your slide, but it says sources. It gives the name of the list that you're working. And in the center column here, where you see all those greens, the NF that you see there stands for not a finding. So somebody's gone through here on this particular program and marked it as not a finding, meaning they're in compliance. You see up near the top, where the O is, that means it's open. It hasn't been reviewed yet. And then this example doesn't show up, but the red portion of the pie chart means that there's a problem with those particular STIGs. So in this example, you can see where there's still room for improvement as you go through your STIGs. And off to the right, you'll see how the STIG is actually written. It shows the rule title, a discussion of what they're looking for. And the important part is down here near the bottom where I've got this arrow, the check text and the fix text. And on each STIG, you'll have a fix text, and that tells you the steps you need to do in order to make sure that you're in compliance with that STIG. The one thing that I don't like about the STIG viewer is that it works on a proprietary file system. So if I'm working on, say, a portion of my traditional security checklist, and then I'm going to send it to somebody else in my department, I have to send them the file. Then they have to upload the file in their STIG viewer. So it makes version control a real problem. But what we found in our office is a new program called the STIG Manager platform. This is an open source program, but in order to access the network that runs on it, you do have to have a what's called a common access card in order to get through this. So you won't be able to use this unless you're somewhere within the Department of Defense. But I do have a video that shows some of what goes on here. So hopefully me playing the video here will work. And I'll please let me know if the video works. And here we go.
This video is an overview of STIG Manager, an open source project from the Naval Undersea Warfare Center, Division Newport, whose champion is Jason Benda. I'm Carl Smigelski from SAIC, and I'm the lead developer of the project. The project is also supported by my colleague Christopher Daly from Right Solutions in Middletown, Rhode Island. Stig Manager is software for organizations that want to collaboratively manage Stig assessments, which are often performed in the context of Steps 3 and 4 of the NIST Risk Management Framework. Stig Manager offers a single source of truth about assets, STIGs, and their current assessment status. That's important to evaluators, managers, package reviewers, ISEs, NQVs, and even to automated tools. All stakeholders can reference and act on the same set of data. Stig Manager includes a web-based user interface with multiple workspaces. There are workspaces for organizing and performing Stig evaluations, a workspace for approving those evaluations, for reporting in Step 5 of the RMF, also workspaces for analyzing evaluation progress and reporting on findings in EMAS POEMS. The web interface is what most end users work with, but Stig Manager also provides a complete application programming interface, or API, that enables system administrators and developers to interact with Stig Manager data in their own programs. The remainder of this video will be a guided tour of the web interface, which is an example of a client that consumes the Stig Manager API. Before we begin, let's take a quick review of Stig Manager terminology and concepts. Stig Manager's primary organizational structure is the collection. A collection contains a group of assets, the entities which are to be evaluated. Each asset in a collection has one or more Stig checklists attached to it. Each checklist might have dozens and sometimes hundreds of individual checks to evaluate, often requiring combined input from multiple evaluators and from automated tools. Stig Manager supports this collaboration by allowing collection owners to grant other users access to the collection's assets and STIGs. For example, Alice might be granted access to all Linux assets in a collection, while Bob's access might be limited to the Windows 10 STIG attached to each of his team's workstations. That's enough background for us to start the tour. We'll pause the presentation here to check for questions and then proceed.
So as you can see, that's a pretty good overview of the Stig Manager, and I really like it because we're using it and it's a one source. So it's web-based. I go in and I work on my portion of the checklist and somebody else can see the work that I've done. And it's not like the other one, the Stig Manager, where we have, or I'm sorry, this Stig Viewer, where we have to send files to each other. So I really like this, and it's actually speeding up our progress as we prepare for our inspection next year.
This video is an overview of.
And here I'm kind of breaking down again what the STIGs look like, this time just in Stig Manager. When you're viewing it, it shows you the kind of like a spreadsheet format where you can just see the rule title, the check. Hopefully everybody can read those. If not, you know, if anybody wants these slides, I can share them with you. The fix and the discussion. And generally, like when we just had our staff assistance visit, the inspector just simply said, it says to do X. Did you do X? If yes, you're good to go. If not, it's a finding and I'm going to write it up. It was that strict. Here's another view within Stig Manager. Again, I want to highlight over here to the right, the fix. This is the important thing, that as we go through and you manage STIGs, whether you're doing it for a DoD or you want to look at your organization and emulate what NIST is calling for in these different areas. For example, here it tells you, ensure the humidity controls have been installed in information technology areas, computer rooms, to protect personnel and equipment operation as follows. And it gives you specific information on, you know, humidity ratings, control systems, that sort of stuff. And you'll see I drew the blue arrow here so you can see that this is a Cat 3. This is minor, but when you click on it in Stig Manager, it pops up over here and you can see what you need to do. And then when you scroll this scroll bar on the right down, it allows you to make notes and make changes to the system. Another tool that's available within Stig Manager, what's called the Security Content Automation Protocol. And what this does is it will send out forgive me, I forget the correct technical term, but it'll send out or seek out your endpoint equipment, your desktops, or whatever you have, and it will look to see if that's in compliance with the particular STIG that you're working on, so that you don't have to go to each particular desktop machine or whatnot. So you've got one, you send out the message, and it sends a report back that out of your 50 machines, 48 of them meet the STIG, but these two IP addresses don't. So then you only have to go and look at those two. And that's the extent of my presentation. I do have it marked as questions, but I'm going to leave the resources marked there if anybody wanted to see this very bottom web address that I have, https://stigviewer.com. And I thought I had another one, but yeah, stigviewer.com/stigs. That's the public.
Oops, I think your mic cut out.
Are you kidding me? I've been talking through all these slides.
No,
I didn't know.
No, I didn't hear all the slides. It's just that little section right there.
Oh, okay. I must have accidentally bumped it because I looked down and saw that my mic was muted there at the end.
Yep. I would have let you know beforehand.
Okay, so that's all that I have.
All right. Thank you. Yep. And thanks to all of our presenters tonight. If you guys have any questions, now's the time to ask. Robin did have to leave early because she had class. So if you have questions for Lauren, Wyatt, or Michael, please let them know, or please ask them, because I'm sure they would be happy to answer them.
Michael, how did you not pull your hair out with all this STIG stuff? Because you seem so calm about it. And I'm like, I would be going crazy.
Well, what I didn't say is that in some of our weekly meetings, there's been a whole lot of finger pointing, yelling and screaming. Not my job. Yeah, it is your job. Go do it. You know, or somebody taking the bull by the horns. But there are literally thousands of STIGs that we have to go through. So it's a long, lengthy process, and if anybody ever has to go through such a procedure, we started this back in June. We were originally told our inspection date would be October, and it got moved to April of next year, and we're thankful that we've got that extra time.
Yeah, it was interesting because I know that I just drew a blank. Nate was trying to get us to follow the NIST model on a project for, you know, a quantum teaming project. So, yeah, I liked a lot of those steps and seeing it all laid out.
No, glad we don't have to do that, though. Thank you. I'm just being honest.
That would be for the project manager to do all that.
Also, for those interested, I fixed my demo that broke. So just for the record.
Yay! I'm proud of you for not saying Jane's unacademic words when that, that didn't work.
I did have an academic related question for Wyatt. When you were talking about the different, the different access?
The access policies?
Yeah. What made you, or what would make a company do the MFA registration policy? Like, I thought that was really interesting. All jokes aside, because I'm like, let me cut this.
We implement it so that if somebody, for some reason, say a hacker in China or Russia, gets access to somebody's account, they could then register their own multi-factor authentication device on the account, and then they could approve their own access into the system. And so by blocking MFA registration from off-prem from the company's IP address. Even if they were to get in somehow with a password, they could not add their own device and then continue to exist within the network. So that's why we do it. We haven't ever had it hit, but it's possible if somebody's password or something was to get leaked or something like that, or device lost or something along those lines, that would prevent them from persisting within the environment.
No, and I definitely get that. I thought my radio was coming through on the recording. I didn't want to have some silly song playing. But is that something, so you're saying that's something that you do at your organization, or is this something that you were talking about in theory, like this is what you would want to do? Because I've never heard of an organization doing that specifically. And I'm just curious, are there attacks that like, and I'm not keeping track of cybersecurity attacks quite yet, to be honest. I'm still on the academic mindset of things, but are there attacks that are being seen where the hacker is trying to do MFA authentication now with credentials?
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay.
So we it is in practice. That rule is in practice at my place of business, and we've implemented that. It works. It's easier, works better, and easier to manage for a small organization. A big company is going to have a hard time with that, just because their people are going to be so spread out. But if you can narrow that down, if you have a smaller organization, it's easy to implement, and it catches a lot of things. If they can't even get their foot in the door, then that's a huge win.
Yeah, that was interesting. They just keep on getting smarter and smarter, these hackers, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's always something new that they come up with.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead, Jane.
Sorry, one other sort of add on to that. As I'm thinking, like when you say a big organization, it's harder for them to implement that. I'm wondering if, I don't want to say where I work at, because now we're talking about cybersecurity related stuff, but my company that I work for, I wonder if that's why they do a lot of the, now you can't have a VPN. If it's, what is it? I think it's like the VPN can't be outside of the United States. Like you can't have a IP address or something like that outside of the United States. And then we still do MFA, like when we log in and authenticate. I think it's through the Microsoft type of programs and stuff like that we use. But even outside of Microsoft, we have like this SSO type of thing. And then it's a MFA app or whatever on our phone. But I just never heard the back end of that. So that was interesting that you were talking about. There's a access policy that's designed around that.
Yeah, you could that could certainly be what they're doing, is blocking access from outside the United States. That's another rule that we have implemented. All of our people are in the U.S. We block incoming traffic from anywhere except for the United States, and most attacks come from overseas. So it by default blocks a lot of that traffic. So, yeah.
All right. Does anybody else have any questions for Wyatt or Michael? Lauren and Robin had to drop. Jane's done. All right. Well, with that, I will close out this meeting. Thank you to our presenters, Robin, Lauren, Wyatt, and Michael. We learned a lot, as always. And everybody have a good day. Make sure if you haven't signed up to present yet that you do so before you graduate. And yeah, have a great rest of your evening.
Thanks, everybody. Great job.